The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from the WGBB studios in Merrick, New York, this is Sports Talk New York.
Good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to Sports Talk New York on WGBB here in Merrick, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue here. I'm taking you through the first hour on this third day of March 2024. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is across the way, as always, taking care of business. Up first tonight, we will welcome in the 11-time Gold Glove shortstop, Omar Vizquel. He'll be with us. In the second half, we speak to a winner of Super Bowl I and II, a member of the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Jerry Kramer will stop by with his buddy and co-author Bob Fox. We're doing well lately and asking football players to join us on the air with Jerry this week and Larry Zonka the last time out. Some great stuff. As always, before I begin, I invite you to follow me on my Facebook page, which is called The Talk of New York Sports. There you'll find show information, sports information, some great pictures. Stop by, give it a look. You can also follow me on X, at B Donahue WGBB. And if you miss a show, don't worry, because they're all out on the website the next day. You can listen to them whenever you want. Well, our first guest, he made an impact on the game since he began playing back in his native Venezuela. He has 11 gold gloves on his resume, including 9 in a row. He's a 3-time All-Star. He owns 2,877 hits. I'd like to welcome to Sports Talk New York tonight, Omar Vizquel. Omar, good evening.
Hi, Bill. How you doing?
We're doing wonderful. I hope everything's doing great with you too, Omar.
Oh, yes, everything is great, especially going back to my country in Venezuela. There is a lot of friends that we have to hang out with.
Yeah.
We researched some of those histories that we have in baseball and everything that is regarding, the success that we have during those years, and just great to get together with my buddies.
I am sure it is. Now, tell us a little bit about the early days playing baseball in Venezuela, Omar.
Well, a lot of competition. You know, as you know, Venezuela have a lot of baseball here. Mm-hmm. It's the number one sport. And I think that every time that you go through the neighborhood, you see baseball fields, you see guys trying to field baseball with different materials. They make gloves out of cartoons and all this stuff, boards. And it's just very exciting to see the growing of baseball in Venezuela. Also, there is over 200 academies that has been showing up all over the place because the farm system from the major league have some problems trying to maintain the teams because the political situations a while back. And now this private academy has been giving a lot of results on bringing prospects to the United States.
That is great news, Omar, certainly. Who was your baseball hero when you were a kid?
I don't know if you remember a guy named David Concepcion, number 13. Playing for the Cincinnati Reds, for the Red Machine for a long time. David played there for 18 or 19 years, and he was the guy that we followed because of my position also, that I played shortstop, and the number that I wear during my career was 13.
Right.
Obviously, get to know David and, when he was retiring late in his career. And right now, I consider him a good friend that we can talk about things that happen in baseball now.
That is nice, Omar. Yeah, Dave Concepcion, folks, a vital cog in that big red machine at shortstop. Really underrated on that ball club. He was a great ball player. Now, you were drafted by the Mariners, Omar. What were your impressions when you first came to America?
Well, it was different. I knew that I needed to adjust to a different custom, to a different country. I tried to open my eyes and open my ears as much as I can. I felt like a little baby, learning new stuff, the language and everything that goes with it. But I knew that I have a responsibility of growing on the world baseball. I knew that I have a chance because I have good tools. I got the enthusiasm, the energy to become a major leaguer. And I think that helped me out to develop in every way, trying to learn as much as I can of the American custom. And I think it worked out good.
We are speaking with the great Omar Vizquel tonight on Sports Talk New York. Now, Omar, you weren't always a switch hitter. Who got you started on switch hitting?
When I was 20 years old, I was already in Double A. My hitting instructor named Bobby Tolan. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, yeah. Another former Cincinnati Red. Yes.
That's right. He asked me. He was working for the Seattle Mariners at the time, and he wanted me to switch. Trying to take advantage of my speed from home plate to first base. And he told me that I was going to be good because all those ground balls from one side to another side of the infielder was going to be a good chance for me to become a hit. Mm-hmm. So, I started making contact with the ball. I started learning. And all of a sudden, the next year, I found myself in Major League. And as you can tell, the transition was pretty hard because, it's not easy to learn how to hit left-handed late in your career. And then all of a sudden you're facing guys like Nolan Ryan and Storm Davis and Dave Stewart and all these guys that were the pitchers at the time. So the process was a little difficult to me. I came back to Venezuela playing the winter ball. I have a good teacher here. Dick Davalillo was in the same baseball team that I was. And, he was a master. And I learned a lot, and I started becoming a better hitter every time.
Two great hitters you mentioned there, Omar. Bobby Tolan and, of course, Vic Davalillo. And they were baseball cards of mine. That's how I remember those guys, Omar. But they were heroes when I was a kid, too. Now, you had guys like Alvin Davis and Harold Reynolds with Seattle helping you along the way, didn't you?
That's right. They were great teachers. Those two guys were like fathers to me. Alvin Davis, a great guy, great person, always talking about good attitude, enthusiasm, leadership. Everything that was about the game, and Harold was my second base combination.
Right.
So I learned a lot from both of these guys. Also, a catcher named Dave Valley, that was a great teacher to me. Great guys on that team. Too bad that we didn't have the chance to play in the playoff. There were stronger teams at the time, but great relationship with these guys.
Now, they moved you shortly after that. They had a guy coming up, folks, by the name of Alex Rodriguez, Seattle did. So they sent Omar packing to the Cleveland Indians, but they had the makings of a great ball club in Cleveland, didn't they, Omar?
Yeah, they were building, that was in 94. They were building a good, solid team. They were looking for a shortstop that can be, a solid guy for them. And my name came up, but they brought me over. And then, I played in Cleveland for 11 years. The rest was history.
Right.
We had the chance to be in a lot of playoff game in two World Series and have the chance to play with some of the best players in the game at the time, Albert Bell, Carlos Baerga, Kenny Lofton, Dave Winfield, Otto Hershiser, Dennis Martinez. Wow, the list goes on and on. But, we have a great team and a great chemistry in between each other. And too bad that we couldn't bring a championship to Cleveland because that was obviously every time that we talk about was to bring a championship to Cleveland.
Right. That was a shame. And I didn't remember, Omar, that Oral Hershiser and Dave Winfield played for the Indians during that period. Thanks for refreshing my memory. Now, in one series, you ran into the Atlanta Braves, who were they were kind of like a powerhouse in the National League while you guys were in the American League. How about the two styles of the Indians versus the Braves? Give us a little insight into that, Omar.
Yeah, that was the series in 95. The Indians had the best team in the American League. Obviously, we count with a great offense, kind of like the Atlanta Braves nowadays, that you got great numbers in every offensive home run, batting average, RBIs, and, we base our team on scoring runs. And then on the other side with the Atlanta Braves, they have the trio pitchers, John Smoltz, Greg Maddux, and Tom Glavine, that everybody was talking about how great the dynasty of the pitching was for them. And obviously, you know, it was a hard contest against them. We got shut down. We couldn't score as many runs as we can to win the ball games, and they were the champions in that year.
Yeah, well, Omar, it's not easy when you got three Hall of Famers on the hill looking down the pipe at you there. I can imagine that. We're speaking with Omar Vizquel tonight on Sports Talk New York. Now, in 1997, you play the Florida Marlins, who were a surprise club in the World Series that year, and you made what you describe as probably the biggest play of your career. Describe that for us.
Yeah, that was the second opportunity that we got to be in the World Series. In 97, we were the favorites to win it, but the Florida Marlins have other ideas. We have some great games going back and forth against them. We played game 7, and then we end up losing that game 3-2. And, you know, yeah, like you said, in game 6 was one of the most talk plays in World Series, diving catch. Going towards the hole, the game was on the line. We were winning 4-2, and made on second and third, and I make a great diving catch going on the hole and stopping a ball and making the play to end up the game. And that play gave us the opportunity to play in game 7, and I think that's the game that every ball player wants to play
right.
in life.
Those are magic words, Omar. Game 7. You're exactly right. Now, a lot of people remember the play that you made to preserve, I believe it was, Chris Bosio's no-hitter when you were with the Mariners.
That's right. There was a high chopper going behind the mound. I barehanded the ball to make the out number 27, the last out of the game.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of talk that they don't know if I deserve to catch the ball barehanded or catch it with the glove. But the situation of the game was so close that I didn't want to pass the opportunity to, you know, to have a close play in first base. And I decided to go barehanded and complete the play. So everything worked out perfect for Chris Bosio. And that was a no-hitter with the Seattle Mariners on 92.
Right. You're exactly right, Omar. Now, the barehanded plays, you sort of became famous for the barehanded play. Did you practice that at all?
I don't think that I go out on the field and start catching balls barehanded, but I think when I was a kid, I developed the skills or catching balls barehanded because we played with no gloves. And the fields were so bad here, the ball bounced all over the place. You always have to be ready for a bad hop. And I think that instinct of catching balls barehanded gave me the opportunity when I came to America to kind of play a little bit with my hand, catching balls barehanded. And it came out naturally. Obviously, there's not something that I practiced, but it just became naturally.
Understood. Yeah, it came naturally to your repertoire. We'll call it that. Now, we talked about the pressure of a game 7, Omar. How do you personally, how do you handle the pressure of a game 7?
Well, that is one of the toughest games mentally that you have to play because all the eyes are kind of like put it on you. You play the game the night before in your mind, mentally. You put yourself into a situation where you're not going to screw it up. You have, like, bases loaded. You have situation where you got two outs, men on third, and a ground ball is hit to you, to your right, to your left. But you never really have the chance to be on the field with 50,000 people and feel that energy that is going towards you. And as much as you can prepare mentally, you know, still the pressure gets to you. And, you know, I feel proud that I was able to handle that situation. And it's just a test of how good you can be playing your game. And I was pretty happy that even though that we lost the game, I was able to handle that situation.
You certainly did. You certainly did. And that's a credit to you, Omar Vizquel, with us tonight on Sports Talk New York. Now, you left Cleveland. How did you feel about leaving the Indians, which, as you said, was your home for so many years?
Yeah, it was pretty sad. I was, disappointed that the Indians couldn't keep me on the team. But obviously, there is a lot of competition. They have a young guy coming up named Johnny Peralta that was right. Playing pretty good. He was the MVP of the Triple A League. So they all the generations of those players playing in the 90s in the playoff and World Series were gone. And I think I was the last one standing. And, it was obviously that they needed to create a new movement of players. And I was one of the oldest there, one of the leaders. But at the same time, they were expanding their prospect and everything. They were cutting on budget and all that. And, they decided to let me go. Well, I went to the San Francisco Giants, a team that is in the National League. First time that I played in the National League. And I was really high expectation because I was playing now with Barry Bonds. Mm-hmm. And it was the first chance that I had to play with one of the best in the game. And it was something different, man. When I was right next to Barry Bonds, it didn't feel real. You know, you see Barry like a god, like something that you put in the pedestal that is unreachable.
Right.
And it was a really, really a strange situation having to hit him, batting practice with him and being in the same lineup. But it was a great time.
All Omar did when he went to the Giants was win two more Gold Gloves, folks. That's it. to add to his collection. Now, 2009, you go to the Texas Rangers, and you really take the role of mentor to Elvis Andrews.
That's right. Now I'm 40 years old. I still play in the position, shortstop. I think that the Texas Rangers have this young prospect from Venezuela named Elvis Andrews that they needed help to kind of like get confidence on his game and get some fundamentals, some basic fundamentals online. And they brought me over to kind of help out with him to become a good shortstop. And I think that I did a good job with Elvis. And from there, it was different because it was the first time that I found myself being kind of like a coach. Mm-hmm. I was already 40 and I didn't play much. I was kind of like talking more about techniques, fundamentals, and situations of the game. And, you know, it kept me on the game mentally, but I was frustrated a little bit because I wanted to play a little more, and I didn't have that opportunity. That's when I went, after that year in Texas, I went to the Chicago White Sox, where I have a little more chance to play.
Right, the White Sox, Omar moves on to Chicago. And what I thought, Omar, is a great honor that Hall of Famer Luis Aparicio, who's also a Venezuelan, he allowed you to wear his number 11 while with the White Sox.
That's right. By the time that I was dealing with the White Sox in conversations with them and my agent, I was doing a baseball clinic with Luis Aparicio. And it just, out of my imagination, I throw the question to him and say, "Hey, Luis, if I ever sign with the White Sox, will you ever let me wear number 11? That was your number."
Yeah.
And he paused for a second, and he said, "Wow, that would be great. Why don't we talk about it with the owners and kind of get it done?" And, 2 days later, the sign happened, and then number 11 was in my locker. So it was amazing.
Yeah, that is a great honor, Omar. That is for sure. Now, what do you consider your greatest record? The Gold Gloves, your 2,800-plus hits. Which one makes you more proud?
You know, there were a lot of things that I did in my career ever since the beginning in 1989. When I was there with 21 years old, I was in the same lineup with Ken Griffey Jr. We made the debut the same day. We came together from Seattle. But I think the fact that I played 24 years in the big league, it was my biggest accomplishment. And why is that? Well, because as your position is one of the toughest in the game, just being able to play the position for a long time, the way that I did, and all the records that I accomplished, and then keep myself in shape in order for you to compete with the young guys and have the chance to play over 42 years old, the position of shortstop, is very remarkable, and people don't realize that everything that you have to do to stay elastic or quick, try to get to balls that people don't think that you're ever going to get, turn the double plays, get the jumps, get the balance, all that come with a price. And I was a guy that loved the gym. I like to keep myself in shape, and I think all that training pay off playing until 45 years old in the big league.
You're right, Omar. That is exactly a testament to you that physically you were able to play for that many years and play at a high level too. Now, you manage Venezuela, your home team, in the 2017 World Baseball Classic. Tell us about your time managing that ball club, Omar.
Well, you know, after your career is over, you start going into coaching, into managing. I have the opportunity to manage the Baseball Classic. First, I participated on the year 2006, and then I was a manager a little later. So I see the both sides of the coin as a player, where you give all your best, everything. You try to bring the team together in order for you to win it all. And then you continue that in a different vision now as a manager, where you kind of put this club together, get the best players of the country, try to set up a mindset and trying to get everybody together to get the goal. And, you know, we couldn't do it, but I was able to say that I was there with the Venezuelan. It looked almost like an Olympic team.
Yeah.
When you have to manage a lot of personalities, a lot of egos, and, you know, it was great to meet them personally, because some of them you see from far away, from the other side of the dugout. But now that you have them on your side, you have to have these conversations on how the guy reacts to different situations, and it was one of the best things that happened to me.
Good point, Omar, definitely. Now, of all the skippers you played for, is there anyone who influenced your management style?
I think that you learn a little bit from everyone. You learn things, do it the right way. You learn things that you don't do and the players don't like. And, you know, I have so many great managers that I think that I have that mindset of respect or doing things the right way, the communication that you have to have with the players, how to treat them, because, you know, everyone is different. And you have to take the time to be patient and try to explain things to them so they can play the game the right way. Try to follow rules that the organization asks you to do, because every team is different. So, you know, it was amazing what I learned from Mike Hargrove, from Charlie Manuel, from Ozzie Guillen, from Bruce Bochy. I mean, these guys were amazing when they deal with players. And, you know, you get a little bit from one of them.
That's right. You mentioned some great names there too, Omar. That's for sure. Now, you happen to hit some, we'll call it bumps in the road, later in your life. How would you explain the part of your journey that maybe you're not so proud of? How would you explain that to younger kids?
Well, yeah, we have to learn from our mistakes. Like you said, I have a couple of bumps in the road, and mm-hmm. You never prepare for, you know, what's coming up. I was bombarded by public opinions on things that happened on my life or the side. I have an ex-wife that tried to get me in trouble. I have another situation with an employer with the White Sox. And, you know, I felt pretty weird, because you never standing on a situation like that. You're not prepared for those moments. And, you know, life is so quick. And I felt pretty bad to what happened also. Because a lot of bad things were said on the press that weren't right, that weren't correct. And now my name has been around this black cloud of bad opinions. But, you know, we clarify things. We were under the eye of the law. I stand there, never hide from the situation. We kind of clarify things and apologize to the people that we needed to apologize publicly. You understand that you make mistakes, and you have to try to get that behind you. now that is behind me. I'm proud that I face all that stuff and it's already on the path. And I want to continue to my baseball career because I know there is a lot of things that I can give to kids, that I can give to the baseball players, and kind of like put that a little bit on behind. I learned a lot through this process, and I needed to the legal process to kind of like come through. And now that I'm clear, I'm happy that I can get back to baseball.
Wonderful. That is a wonderful viewpoint and a wonderful way to look at some troubles that we may have in life. Everybody experiences them, Omar, and baseball players are no different, folks. And Omar's doing the right thing, and he's getting back with baseball. If there was one guy, Omar, who would be your buddy throughout the years, one great teammate, who would that be?
Well, I have a lot of great guys. Jim Thome is one that comes to mind, but I think Carlos Baerga has been the one that has given me support during all these hard times. He played for the Cleveland Indians for a while, was my second base partner for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And Carlos has been very supportive of what I've been doing and how to kind of reach out to people to understand that I'm not the guy that they kind of put it on the press, that that I'm something different. And I think when you have a career the way that I had, when, you know, I play a long time and I never got into trouble in any way, and all of a sudden something like this happened, you understand that was a mistake that you make, that you kind of want to apologize to the people, that you feel bad, that nothing bad was behind this thing, and they understand that. And all that I want is another opportunity to kind of, go back and teach the game and teach all these values that were important to me and my teammates and everything that I live on the baseball career. So Carlos Baerga has been that guy that has been there next to me.
Good man. We had him here with the Mets for a while, Carlos Baerga. And I think your viewpoint is right on, Omar. People have a tendency to forget and forgive, especially in the sports world. People who are contrite like you are and learn their lesson, people have a tendency to forgive and forget. And I think that you're on the right road, and that is going to be your outcome. I really hope. Do you have anything happening upcoming? And any clinics, anything happening in Venezuela? What's going to happen with you in the next couple of months?
Well, I'm still together. I'm still in contact with baseball teams. I'm doing a lot of teaching in academies. We're teaching the right fundamentals of the game. We try to put these guys in situations where they're not going to fail, because I know how hard it is coming from my country and going into a different custom, the problems that they can face. And how MLB has been very demanding on all these rules that they're putting nowadays. So we have to let these kids know what's going on out there, what can be the complications that they can face. And obviously that is important to me coming from Venezuela. But we have been doing a lot of baseball clinics. I just came from Panama doing a weekend with kids out there. We're going to go to Costa Rica doing some baseball stuff. We're going to go to Ecuador. I did Argentina 3 years ago. So we always preaching the world of baseball and how important it is for me to speak about leadership, about discipline, about all these things that help me out to be successful. And now they have to face that and understand that it's not going to be easy. Besides your talent, you also have to do something else to stay in the game and to maintain yourself and be a role model. So it is important for me to do that and continue to do that in America. The other baseball clinic, we're trying to do clinics in Texas, where I live right now, and other cities around it. But I want to reconnect with MLB. I want to reconnect to the alumni association that they do a lot of baseball clinics, and also try to do some work with the Boys and Girls Club. I think it's important for us to give back everything that we learned.
Great lessons to be learned, Omar. Omar Vizquel, it's been an honor and a pleasure. I thank you for taking time out of your Sunday evening to spend it with us back here in New York. We wish you nothing but the very best, Omar. Take care. Do the best you can, and you're going to come back to number one.
Thank you very much, Bill. I appreciate your time, and I know that, it's Sunday, and you're also working, so it gives you, it tells you about how great and when you work on a Sunday evening, so congratulations.
Thank you, Omar. You take care, buddy.
Bye-bye.
That is Omar Vizquel, ladies and gentlemen. Up next on Sports Talk New York, we'll welcome in Jerry Kramer and Bob Fox. Stick around, folks.
You're listening to Sports Talk New York. Tune in every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Long Island's WGBB. Broadcasting on 95.9 FM and 1240 AM. Or listen live online at WGBBRadio.com. Stay connected to Sports Talk New York on WGBB by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WGBB Sports Talk. You're listening to Sports Talk New York on Long Island's WGBB. And now, back to the show.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we are back with Sports Talk New York here on WGBB. I'd like to thank you for stopping by and hanging with us on a beautiful, dare I say, spring Sunday night here on Long Island. I just want to mention a gentleman that we're going to have with us on the 13th, God willing, Scott Howard Cooper. He's written a book called Kingdom on Fire. It's about UCLA and the great players and coaches who have passed through there. Chaucer's Books out in California is going to host Scott Howard Cooper for a virtual author discussion. You could get it online. He's going to also have former UCLA basketball coach Gary Cunningham. This is this Monday, March 4th at 7 p.m., and they'll talk about the tradition of Blood in the Garden. The three-ring circus comes to mind, too. A narrative history of really the iconic UCLA Bruins championship teams, led by, of course, the Wizard of Westwood, John Wooden. An incredible story about the never-easy pursuit that is perfection set against really the turmoil of American culture that was in the 60s and 70s. So if you want to check out this event before Scott comes on the program, go to chaucersbooks.com. You can get the link there. It's going to be a Zoom event. You can also participate, and that is quite noteworthy and worthy of your attention. So I'm going to move on now to our next guest, Jerry Kramer. He is a former professional football player, author, and sports commentator. He played 11 years as a guard and kicker with the Green Bay Packers of the NFL. Inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 2018, Mr. Bob Fox, his writing has appeared in outlets including Packer Report, Wisconsin Sports Online, and Bleacher Report. He was also a supervising producer on the documentary, You Can If You Will, The Jerry Kramer Story. I'd like to welcome back to the show tonight Jerry Kramer and Bob Fox. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening, Bill.
Doing, Bill.
Nice to be with you.
Great to have you guys. Now, I want to ask both of you, growing up, who were your sports heroes? Jerry, you can go first.
Probably Johnny Weissmuller, Tarzan. I was in northern Idaho, a small town of 300, 400 people, something like that, and we didn't, and then there was a player with the San Francisco 49ers, Crazy Legs Hirsch.
Oh, yeah.
You remember Crazy Legs?
Yes, sir.
I think he was either with the Niners or the Rams, but he was one of my heroes also. So between Tarzan and Crazy Legs, one of the two.
You had great choices, Jerry, that's for sure. How about you, Bob? Who did you root for when you were a kid?
Well, growing up in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee Braves were still around at the time until they moved to Atlanta in 1966. So in baseball, Hank Aaron was my hero. And in football, Bart Starr was my hero. What was really great about, obviously Hall of Fame people and Hall of Fame athletes, but I was able to interview both of them at one time, which you talk about a kid in a candy store feeling to be able to do that. You're, you know, the icons that I grew up with. And obviously getting to know the Packers, became a big fan of this guy, especially after Instant Replay came out in 1968. And, of course, I'm talking about Jerry.
Right. What a classic book that is. We'll talk to that, to discuss that later on a bit with the great Dick Schaap that was written with now. Jerry, what was it like playing college football in Idaho?
It was a big thrill for me. I came out of a town of about 3,000 people. It was a small town in northern Idaho. And my family had not been to college. And so it was a unique possibility for me to be the first member of the family to go to college. And I had the University of Washington recruiting me. So I was torn back and forth, and the University of Washington got me a job down in southern Idaho and kind of hid me and expected me to come over to the University of Washington to go to school. And then the University of Idaho coach got me and brought me up to the University of Idaho. And long story short, I ended up going to the University of Idaho and having a wonderful career there and a wonderful group of guys and an education. So Idaho was in my heart and in my soul, and it still is.
And the rest is history, as they say, Jerry. That is a great story. Now, I want to ask both you guys, you can if you will. Now, that was something Jerry mentioned in his Hall of Fame speech. Bob, tell us a little bit what that means to you. You can if you will.
Well, as Jerry's talked about that thing, you know what? I think it's about having perseverance, being passionate about what you want to do. Everybody has a goal. I'm sure you had a goal at some point in your life, Bill, about becoming a broadcaster, being in the business you're in, and then actually having it happen's got to make you feel great. And it's sort of like I wanted to be in the media out of college, and I did. I was in television for a while, and then after a while I ended up in sales because it's just the way it worked out. And I always wanted to get back into the media, and so I kept pushing and pushing and pushing, knocking on doors, and it finally happened. And I think that's really what that whole phrase is all about. You can if you will. A lot of people won't or don't,
right?
But I did. And you've done it, and Jerry's done it, and I think that's what it all means.
How about to you, Jerry? What does that phrase mean to you?
I was a sophomore in high school, and I wanted to be a fullback. My brother was a running back, and an older brother, and I wanted to be a fullback. And I was in practice, and I was a sophomore with big feet and big hands and big ideas and not much else. But I'm trying to play, and my coach is telling me that if I want to play, I'm going to be a lineman. If I want to sit on the bench, I can be a fullback. And a line coach comes over to me in the middle of a practice, and he's an older gentleman and kind of semi-retired, and he's got a kind of a Mona Lisa smile about him, and he looks at me and he said, "Son, you can if you will." Mm-hmm. And I said, "Can what? If I will what? What are you talking about? What do you mean? What are you saying?" And he was walking away, and he turned around and looked at me, and he just said, "You can if you will." And he left me to think about it. And so for the first time, I thought about the intellectual, mental side of sports and how you could go at 10%, 20%, 90%, 100% if you will, if you wanted it, if you wanted it badly enough. Then it changed my whole attitude and my whole life. And after that, reacting with Coach Lombardi was another elevator, another step, another notch in the gun. But it was a high school thing that started me on it. And when we get down a little bit further, there's an emotional part of the game. And I didn't know that. I just thought I was a shot putter. And I'd shot myself with a 10-gauge double-barrel shotgun, hunting young kid, 15 years old, 16, something like that, and damn near killed myself. But I survived, and I was in the track meet, and I had qualified for the state pro with the bad arm, the right arm. And the first, there was an audience of about 8,000 people in Boise, and my hometown was like 300 or 400. And so I'm warming up, and I get a call from the officials. Okay, Kramer, you're up. So there are four judges there. And just as I get in the ring, the loudspeaker says, "And now from Sandpoint, Idaho, Jerry Kramer." And the crowd cheered, and I just clutched. I just choked. And I went ahead and threw the shot put, and it went 30 feet. And my best throw had been up close to 50. So this is a state meet where we have all of the schools together, right? Mm-hmm. And we've got four judges, and they're out watching where the shot is landing. And they say, "Well, it was way up there. Well, I didn't see it." Well, it was, and 15 minutes later, they decided to give me another throw because this was so short. And so now I get mad. I get angry. I get emotional. And I get in the ring, and I go 51-10. And I set a new state record, the record that lasts for 17 years. And I'm going, "What was that? How did that happen? What happened to me?" And so I started thinking about the power of the brain and the emotions and the difference it could make in your performance. And for the rest of my life, I tried to play with a generated anger. It was not real, but it was temporary. And I would start Thursday night, Friday night, I'd some more on Saturday and Sunday, and I played with great emotion. And I believe that emotion gave me extra energy and extra power. And so I played with it for the whole career in Green Bay. And it made a lot of sense to me then, and it still does.
It took you very far, Jerry, that's for sure. You kids out there, you can if you will. Write that down. Look at it. Learn it. See what it means to you. It's going to help you to the way it helped Jerry, I'm sure. Now, the 1958 draft, Jerry, 39th selection in the fourth round, the Green Bay Packers really had a hell of a draft, though, that year, didn't they?
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. I you know, was a young kid from the sticks, and didn't have an advisor. I didn't have a manager. I didn't have any help at all. So I went to a East-West Shrine game, and I talked to the general manager of the Packers. The Packers were in San Francisco playing the Niners. And so the Packer general manager was there, and he wanted me to sign a contract. And so I thought, well, I want a little bonus, you know. I want and asked him for a $250 bonus, and he said, "Fine, we can do that." So he gave me a check for $250. So I go to camp a month later, go to the All-Star game. I got fortunate enough to play in, and then we went to camp in Green Bay. And my first check, there's a $250 deduction in it. And I go, "Wait a minute." Vern Llewellyn was the general manager, and I said, "What is this? That was a bonus." "No, Jerry, that was an advance." I signed for $77.50 instead of $8,000.
Wow!
But it was an interest, and the Green Bay Packers were 1-10-1 my first season.
Yeah.
Worst record in the history of the franchise. The Baltimore Colts, very vivid memory. In Baltimore, the white Colt of the Baltimore's mascot was running around the stadium every time Baltimore scored. Baltimore beat us that day 56-0, and we damn near killed the Colt.
Yeah.
So that was before Lombardi. The year before Coach Lombardi, we were 1-10-1, as one of the great columnists, Red Smith, used to say, we whelmed one, we overwhelmed one, and we underwhelmed 10.
Right.
So, worst record in the history of the game.
For those folks that don't know, the other guys taken in the 58 draft just happened to be Jim Taylor out of LSU and Ray Nitschke from Illinois. So three Hall of Famers in one draft, that's not too bad. And like Jerry says, in comes Vince Lombardi in 59, who was, if you don't remember, he was the offensive coach of the New York Giants. So the Giants let another great coach slip away. And the rest, as we say, is history. Bob, out of these Hall of Fame Green Bay Packers, who have you been lucky enough to speak with?
I was able to talk to, and here's the funny thing about it is, speaking of Ray Nitschke, I met Ray before my media. Well, actually, it was in between my media when I first got into the business, and later on I wrote for Packer Report, which was my first media writing job. And guess who was the founder of Packer Report? That was Ray Nitschke himself.
Wow.
So okay. I got to be able to write for the publication he founded. And I met him once at a tailgate party in Tampa, just briefly, like all the other fans. But, I always enjoyed watching him play. And, I've talked just about, Dave Robinson, he's good friends of Jerry's. I've met Dave many times. He's another Hall of Famer. Obviously, I mentioned I was able to interview Bart and players of that stature. But, you know, you were talking about that 58 draft. And, you know, Dan Curry was the number one pick in that draft by the Packers, linebacker. And, you know, he, had he not hurt his knee, he could have been a Hall of Famer. He had a serious knee injury and ended up getting traded to the L.A. Rams for a pretty good receiver named Terrell Dale.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another guy who got cut, and Jerry can tell the story better than I. But Jerry was basically fighting for one position on the roster in 58, and he was fighting between he and Ken Gray, another guard, and Scooter McClain ended up keeping Jerry. And Ken Gray ended up signing with the Chicago Cardinals because they were in Chicago then. And Kenny Gray had a pretty good career. He went to about 5 or 6 Pro Bowls, had a good career. But Jerry tells the story better about what Kenny Gray said to him after he found out he got cut and Jerry kept the roster, stayed on the roster. What was that, Jerry?
Well, it was in training camp, of course, and we had been to the East-West Shrine Game in Chicago and came up a little bit late for camp, so I was a little bit behind. But Kenny Gray, my coach at the College All-Star Game had told me I would not make the Green Bay team, but that I could play somewhere. But Green Bay had like 5 returning guards or 5 guards, and I probably wouldn't make the team. So this is a guy that had played professional football and I assumed was a pretty, you know, savvy guy. And so I went up to Green Bay and I am, having a pretty good time. I'm checking the crowd out, hanging out with the guys and telling stories and, shipping bulls and all that. And Scooter McClain called me into his office, and he said, "What is wrong with you?" And he started chewing on me a little bit, and I said, Coach, I'm waiting to be traded. He says, "What do you mean you're waiting to be traded?" Well, my college all-star coach told me I wouldn't make the team and that I would be traded. So I just kind of expect to be traded.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't draft you to trade you. You're starting next week. So, wow, all of a sudden I get thrust into the lineup. And my first antagonist was Artie Donovan from the Baltimore Colts. Artie was a big guy, probably 6'4", 6'5", but an awfully heavy guy, probably 300 pounds.
Big man, yeah.
And he was a wiggler and a shaker. And he a lot of guys will try to run over you. They'll try to give you an arm or a variety of different objectives, but it's all to get to the quarterback. And so Artie would he would just stand up, and he would wiggle, shake from side to side, and he would wait for you to move. And as you couldn't stand it anymore after 2 or 3 seconds, you'd try to hit him. He would go sideways like a matador and pull you forward and go to the quarterback. Well, I played against him that day, and I don't think I touched him the whole ball game. he just wiggled and dodged is all he did. So I finally have a couple pretty good games, and they release two of the guards, and they go to New York, and they make the club in New York. And then it's Kenny Gray and I, and he's doing pretty well, and I'm starting to get some confidence, and I'm starting to play, and I'm starting to pick things up. And he gets traded, and we're down at the newsstand buying some magazines, and he's across the street. And he looks at me and he said, "You blankety blank blank blank, you had a no-cut contract, didn't you?" And I said, "What the hell is a no-cut contract?"
Yeah.
And so, yeah, from Idaho, fourth round choice. He got traded to St. Louis and had a great career and was a fine football player, but I felt very fortunate I didn't know how good I was. I didn't know where I was. I didn't know if I could compete. I didn't know if I was strong enough. I didn't know if I was smart enough. I didn't have much confidence in myself. But it came along with the coaching after. And so Scooter was my first coach, and we were 1-10-1, worst record in the history of the franchise. And Vincent Thomas Lombardi is hired, and the whole world turns over and turns upside down and inside out and backwards, and we start all over again.
Yeah, and amazing as it is, definitely. Now, I want to tell you guys, for all the time I've been doing this, I try to keep a file, a thumb drive of all the interviews I do, and the only one that they lost that I never got to hear again was the one with the golden boy, Paul Hornung. And, I was so disappointed when I heard they lost that file. But give us a good Paul Hornung story, Jerry.
Oh, Jay, he was so dapper, so handsome, so cool, so confident. You know, he's just a wonderful ball player. And just a very bright, interesting, fascinating human being. And, he and I got together, on the Packers suite. When Coach Lombardi arrived, Paul Hornung became his number one guy. We will run this play, and we will run it again and again and again until we make it go. We can run to the right, we can run to the left, but we are going to run the Packers sweep.
Right.
So Paul Hornung was carrying the ball for that sweep. And he and I was not a real speed demon, but I had good speed. And Paul had good speed, but he was not much faster than I was. So it made it really easy for him to be behind me. And he was a very bright runner, very intelligent. And so when the D-back or the linebacker or whoever was trying to get past me, Paul would make a step outside and draw the defensive tackler toward him and then make the step back inside for me to block the guy. And if I was on my feet, I could hit the guy, knock him down, and go on to the next guy,
okay.
Which was what I, what I really loved to do. That was my goal, and hopefully get three of them maybe at one time.
Nice.
But he was bright, he was funny, he was witty, he could dance. We're at a function in Milwaukee at a hotel early in our career in those first two or three years. And we're on maybe the fourth or fifth of the floor of the hotel, and there's a program going on with a piano and a singer and whatnot. And the maitre d' of the hotel wants to introduce us. There's five or six of us, right? So he introduces me, and I step forward, and I wave my hand, and I don't say a word. I just kind of do a shy little wave to the crowd, and the next guy the same, and the next guy the same, and the next guy, and the next guy, and they save Paul for last. And Paul is introduced, and he grabs the microphone, and he starts singing. Goody, goody. And he's doing a little tippity tappity, tippity tappity, tippity tappity too. And I'm looking at him like, what in the hell is this?
Yeah.
He had that kind of composure and that kind of confidence and that kind of an attitude. And he was just a kick in the pants to be with. And a wonderful ball player, and we miss him greatly.
A wonderful man. Well, Jerry Kramer and Bob Fox, we're going to have to do this again because I got more stuff here and we're out of time. But I tell you, it's been a pleasure having you guys with us again tonight. I thank you for taking the time out of your Sunday night to spend it with us up here on Long Island. The best of luck to both you guys. We'll do it again soon. I'll be in touch. Bob Fox and Jerry Kramer, folks. Have a good night, gentlemen.
Thank you, Bill. Appreciate it.
That'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk New York. I'd like to thank my guests, Omar Vizquel and Bob Fox and Jerry Kramer, and, of course, my engineer, Brian Graves, and you guys for joining us. See you in a bit, folks. With any luck, I'll be back in a few weeks. Till then, be safe, be well. Bill Donahue wishing you a good evening, folks.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.